Hi there. I'm so excited to welcome you to the Arthritis Life podcast, where we share arthritis life stories and tips for thriving with autoimmune arthritis. My name is Cheryl Crow, and I am passionate about helping people navigate real life with arthritis beyond joint pain. I've been living with rheumatoid arthritis for 20 years, and I'm also a mom, occupational therapist, video creator, support group leader, and I created the Room to Thrive self-management program. I am so excited to help you live a more empowered life with arthritis. We're going to cover everything from kitchen life hacks to navigating the healthcare system to coping with friends who just don't get it. Seriously, no topic is going to be off limits on this podcast. My interviewees and I share our honest stories of how chronic illness affects our lives. This includes discussions about mental health, sex, shame, pregnancy, body image, advocacy, self-acceptance, and so much more. You'll hear stories from all ends of the spectrum, from a person who's living in Medicaid remission from psoriatic arthritis to somebody living with severe mobility restrictions and severe pain from rheumatoid arthritis. You'll hear how people manage their conditions in different ways, like medications, mindfulness, movement, social support, work accommodations, and so much more. You'll also hear from rheumatology experts who just get it. We'll dive deep into the science behind chronic pain and what's the latest evidence for lifestyle changes that can help you thrive with arthritis, including exercise, sleep, nutrition, stress reduction, and more. This is your chance to sit down and chat with a friend who's been there. Ready to figure out how to manage your arthritis life? Let's get started. I am so excited to have back on the Arthritis Life podcast one of my most repeat people, which is so great, Paulina Barinska. Can you give the audience a quick introduction to who you are, like where you live? What is your relationship to arthritis?
Yes. Hello back. It's so good to be here again. I'm Paulina. I was born in Poland, raised in England, but I live in Munich, Germany. And I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis in 2014 at the age of 18.
Wow. And, you know, some of the people who've listened to the previous episodes with you, I will link to those, by the way. The famous methotrexate panel chat, which is my most downloaded one on YouTube, or most viewed on YouTube, and one of the top three most listened to podcasts, but also a couple others. But can you, you know, for anyone who hasn't heard yet, summarize your diagnosis journey? And it's hard to summarize it, but, you know, whatever you want to share about it.
Yeah, totally. So I guess the shortest summary when it comes to my diagnosis per se was that it didn't happen gradually, my condition. I think like this is something that I find differentiates my journey from a lot of people whom I've spoken to, have heard about. For me, it literally happened overnight. So I was an 18-year-old who was working in corporate. So I had a full-time job that I had to drive to 40 minutes by car with. I was a partner dancer, which I still do, but I was doing it a lot more regularly back then. So pretty much twice, three times a week in the evening after work, come home, eat, go out dancing and doing that sort of things. Very social, going to the gym, very active. I mean, I was an 18-year-old working and doing all sorts of things. And then literally, and it seems like a lie when I look back at it, but it really isn't. I woke up one day and I had swollen all finger joints. My wrists were all swollen to the point that it was so painful. I couldn't do my buttons up. I couldn't even open the door to the house with the keys. I literally remember knocking at my neighbor's doors to be like, please help me. I can't even get inside the house.
That's a lot.
So, and then I just went to the doctors in England. I was living in England at that time. Unfortunately, the GP system there is not like your house doctor, your family doctor is not really the best. At least it wasn't back then and it wasn't in my area. And so they prescribed me paracetamol and ibuprofen and be like, yeah, this will just get better and just take this every day for 2 weeks. Well, it didn't, obviously. And then I went back and the same thing again, and they didn't want to test me. So I had to go to the emergencies, because when you go to the emergencies and the doctor there sees you and they prescribe like a test or something, then your GP takes you seriously. And they're like, oh, okay, let us really look into this. And that's basically what happened. I went to the emergencies, sat there for God knows how long. And eventually the doctor saw me, he did the test, like he touched me as well, like which my GP never did. He never touched my swollen joints either. And then he prescribed that I get more tests done, and the GP then took that more seriously. And that's when I was diagnosed with seronegative rheumatoid arthritis, actually. So it was more through speaking to a rheumatoid arthritis doctor about my symptoms, about my, yeah, like what I'm feeling, because the blood markers weren't really showing anything.
Yeah, and I think it's such a strange thing where, you know, you present as such a young, active person, and a lot of times the doctors think, or they're trained, like if you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. I don't know if you've heard that phrase, but and it's really frustrating because you're like, it's not normal to wake up one morning with especially bilateral joint pain on both sides of the body, the degree of swelling you had. So I'm sorry you didn't get taken seriously earlier. And, you know, for those who don't know, a physical exam is a really important part of the diagnosis, usually done by the rheumatologist because they have like extensive training. Like my rheumatologist, you know, she's feeling the precise angles when she, you know, they're like, I was like, wow, you have like magical fingertips, because she's able to just tell like so, you know, quickly with her, they're trained in that physical exam. So it's not just blood work as your story shows, it's the physical exam and the pattern of symptoms too. So yeah, that's a lot. And what was your treatment journey like over the last, you know, number of years living with this?
Yeah.
10 years, decade.
Oh my God.
I just realized that. Yeah.
My God, you're right. Wow. That did not even somehow compute into my head.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't feel like 2014 was 10 years ago in some ways, but yeah.
Wow. Yeah, 10 years ago. And I kept thinking it's like 7 years ago. I just stuck at seven and I just stayed there. Yeah. Okay, so 10 years ago, yeah, my treatment journey has been all over the place. And I moved countries midway through that as well, which made things even different. But initially in the beginning, when I finally got taken seriously and I ended up at my rheumatologist, the first thing that I believe they do for everybody in the UK, at least, and this is what happened to me too, I was put on methotrexate. I can't remember how much. I think it was 25 milligrams every day. It must have been a high dosage. I remember also, every day. I think it was like
every week.
Once a week. Yeah. But I was also on steroids, and I remember taking them more frequently because, I mean, yeah, it was like such a huge flare up right from the beginning, and they were trying to manage that. And that in that moment when I've actually got the diagnosis and I could finally sort of understand what's happening in my body, well, not really understand, I kind of knew what to Google. I knew what to research, because nobody in my family, nobody that I knew in my life, in my world, ever had rheumatoid arthritis. So it's not even something I had any knowledge about. So I received the diagnosis. I was put on methotrexate and steroids, and I immediately went into Google. I was like full on search mode. What the hell? What do I do? What is actually really going on? And I think the fact that I am very naturally persistent and I naturally don't give up, I just didn't give up on myself. And I was like, okay, this is the medication that they've given me. They've told me that this is the medication I'll have to be on for the rest of my life. That's not something an 18-year-old likes to hear. So I was like, okay, well, there must be something else that I can do. And I really don't know where that thought even came from. Really, I can't even tell you, because at that point, I've never been to therapy. I've never done any self-development work. I was never like looking after my health as I understand it now. So I really don't know. It was just sort of something that inside of me knew that I need to do.
Yeah. That, well, I think that it's I think that you mentioned that, you know, you're a very persistent person and it sounds like very thorough. So I think it is a natural question many people come up, you know, come up with pretty quickly in their journey is there something else I could be doing either alongside these medications or instead of the medications? You know, I think it's a very natural question, right? So it's one that I think a lot of people are hovering in that Google search bar. It's one of the ones they're searching. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, it had to make sense. This is where I am and I'm at now. So it had to make some sort of sense and it was there for a reason. But yeah, so through that search, I discovered things like actually eating things that are anti-inflammatory and eating in a way that supports my body's function rather than just eating for eating because I'm hungry, which is all that I knew at that point. Or movement, like what really is it? I just knew about the gym and bulking up and building muscle and being all sorts of stuff like that. So I really quickly started implementing those changes. And because I never really did anything like that before in terms of even nutrition, I feel like that gave me such a huge benefit because it was sort of like all at once I was doing something my body was clearly begging for. And 6 months down the line, I, without even negotiating this with my doctor, just stopped my medication. Please don't do this.
Whoever's do not recommend. But, you know, we're all human. And this is why we share the stories, you know, to see this is the real world. They call it like medication non-compliance in like the, you know, in the medical world. But it's common to try. I'm like such a brown noser, like an A student, where I'd be like, no, I have to talk to the teacher first and ask. But a lot of other people are more going rogue.
That's definitely what happened to me. I was like, nope, I trust myself. I started all these supplements and vitamins and food and everything. It's like, no, I'm going to stop this medication and just see what happens. Because I was feeling good at the 6 month mark because I was on high dose medication. However, I managed to stay in remission for 2 years. So I don't know. I don't advise anybody to do this, but somehow it just ended up working for me. And then 2 years later, so I was in remission for 2 years, I changed countries. I moved to Germany where I am now. And now with the knowledge that I have about stress and our nervous system and autoimmune conditions all intertwined, I can very strongly say that the stress of moving, new country, new language, new people, and really not knowing anybody, just gave me the biggest flare of like ever. It then jumped from my hands into my ankles, my elbows even more. So like in areas that I never felt it before. So I very quickly found a doctor here. Luckily, the system seems, and so far I've had much better experiences here. I feel actually looked after and listened to much more than I did in the UK. But it's about trial and error, finding the right doctors, and again, staying persistent about that to make sure that we find someone like that. And here I was put on methotrexate again, but on an injection form, whereas in the UK I was given the pill form. They don't do that here. They actually more go towards injections than pills, which was scary for me because I was like, okay, that's better. But injections by myself, to myself?
Yeah, like, am I allowed? Yeah, I remember that being weird. But if you're listening, it's a lot of people don't know that if you have nausea, specifically associated with taking the oral tablets of methotrexate, that nausea usually goes away or gets a lot less if you take the injection and injected form. So that's there's not very many quick swaps in rheumatology, but that's one. So
definitely. Yeah. And I definitely felt less side effects with the injection. So I actually stayed on that for a few years and then stopped sort of working. I started getting flare-ups more frequently. So we changed into a biologic. We changed for a Cimzia, which I was on for 2 years. Worked like a magic thing. It just helped to sort out all the flares I was having with methotrexate. It clearly was a good change. However, and I spoke about this in our last episode with the girls catching up as well, However, I got a really weird symptom of like back rib cage pain that I've never had before. And obviously that worried my doctor a little bit because it was very aligned with the change of medication to Cimzia. So then because of that and talking together, we changed me again to Rinvoq, which is one of the newest medications, at least here in Europe. I know that in America, they've used it a lot longer than they have been in Europe. And then I was back again. Cimzia was also an injection. And then Rinvoq was again a pill form, an oral form. So that was also another change for me. And I was on that for around a year. And that is daily. And it helped, like, again, just like in a week's period time, all of those pains I was having again with Cimzia just sort of managed to help me very quickly. So I feel like my journey with treatments was very positive in the sense that whatever I was put on, I seemed to feel better after. And a huge celebratory moment, which I also shared last time in our podcast, is that since October, so we're in February right now as we're recording this, but in October 2023, so just a few months ago now, I stopped taking Rinvoq as well. And now I'm in sort of unmedicated remission, one can yes. say, and spoken to my doctor about this.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and that is, you know, it is the way to do it, is to do it, you know, in slowly stair-step ways, from what I understand, in conjunction with your doctor. And it's not, it depends on so many variables, you know, whether you're seronegative or seropositive, how severe and aggressive your RA has been, but it certainly is possible for some people to slowly wean down and sustain off of their medications and sustain the remission. Again, it's not like in my case, it's not something that my body has ever shown it will be able to do so far, but in the future it could happen, you know? So it's, you know, anyway, but back to your story. So that's, yeah, I think I was just thinking back to when I got diagnosed in 2003, and I thought, I just laugh sometimes. I mean, in a compassionate way, how I kind of thought that I would just be on these two medications the rest of my life, like methotrexate and Enbrel. I really didn't know how common it was to have to do this guessing game or switching, or it works for a while, then it doesn't. And so for anyone listening, I know that can be a little stressful to hear, but it's definitely like knowledge is power. And like, for me, I wish I had known so that I didn't take that initial 6 years of medicated remission kind of for granted, because I just thought it was going to last forever, you know?
Yeah. And I think this just proves again to us how important it is for us to stay persistent in finding the right doctors. Mm-hmm. And by the right doctors, I mean the ones that we feel comfortable with. Because the moment we trust our doctor and they trust us, this is what happened with me and my doctor right now. It's like we both trust each other, and I know she is helping me because of all of her knowledge and expertise, right. But she's also learning from me because I am the one experiencing all of this. So there has to be communication between us both. And thanks to that, we were able to be like, okay, let's try this out nice and slow. Like you said, let's try it out. Let's see what the body responds to and see how it feels. And we work together through this. So it is stressful, like you said, to see that there's so many medications and so many changes that could be happening in our medication journey and treatment journey. But if we focus on finding a doctor that can make this at least a little bit easier for us, it makes such a huge difference.
Absolutely. I'm curious, how did you find your doctor? Did you have to do some trial and error? Did you get a word of mouth?
I feel very lucky.
Yeah.
I feel very lucky, actually. So I moved here into Germany. Here, when you want to see a specialist, you don't have to go through your GP. You don't have to go through your family doctor. Like in the UK, you have to go there, then they recommend you to somewhere else. Whereas here, you're able to just make an appointment. However, you can't just make an appointment to a rheumatology doctor because the waiting times for new patients without any recommendation, like from a different doctor, are months and months apart. And I was completely in a huge flare. I couldn't walk. I was limping everywhere because of my feet and hands and everything swelling and then flaring up. So I knew I needed sort of like a quick fix, let's say. And I went to an orthopedic orthopedist. Yeah, orthopedist, because he's one of the ones that we can get an appointment to very fast. And he had contacts. He literally, with me sitting in the room, he called his friend, or, you know, let's friend doctor, as they have each other's contacts, and just explained the situation that I'm in. And I went to hers the day after. I had to wait a very long time at her, let's say waiting area clinic, because she was seeing me in between patients and in between appointments. But because he called her, she was like, okay, this woman really needs like my help. So let me fit her in quickly for 5 minutes in between the patients that she was having. So I feel very lucky, and I've managed to actually go to the doctor, which I didn't know at the time is the head of the clinic, for rheumatology. So I feel very grateful, very lucky that I managed to land on one that I feel good with.
Well, that's a great, you know, I often tell people to, if they're looking for like a physical therapist or occupational therapist, ask at your rheumatologist office who they tend to know and refer to and like. And so that's a great, on the other side, if you want to find a good rheumatologist, you can ask the other specialists that tend to work with them, like physical medicine and rehab doctors, who are also called physiatrists or orthopedists. I think that's a great tip, you know, and I don't think it's the most normal situation to have them immediately call like the best doctor ever and get in the next day, but it's, you don't know till you try, right?
No. And it's true. I mean, I haven't had this experience of, let's say, looking or trying to get a good doctor when it comes to rheumatology, but I have in other areas. So let's say gynecologist, I am still trying to find one that I fully trust and can go to. So I sort of understand it in the different sort of way from the different doctor that it applies for. And I know how it's just a lucky game or a trial game. But yeah, like you said, Cheryl, you will not know if you don't ask. And the only thing that can happen is that they will say, no, sorry, we don't know anybody. And nothing changes then. But they could say that they know somebody, and you might be like a little step closer to actually finding someone that you also feel good with.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing when you can find such a good relationship with a provider. I didn't realize how lucky I was. And it was just the first person my general doctor recommended me to, you know. I didn't do any research. I didn't just took it at face value. She's good enough for you. If she's good enough for you, she's good enough for me, you know? And I immediately loved her. Being lucky, highly recommend. No, but so the other thing we were going to talk about today, you and I were chatting the other day about how sometimes you can feel like your rheumatoid arthritis is a bit of like a blessing in disguise, which is a hard thing to say or communicate about, because you don't want to say that like, I'm so happy that I have this, like, no, but given that like it had to happen to me, I can feel grateful for some of the things that it's brought to me. So I'd love to hear more about what you're thinking about related to that question.
Yeah. And I, for everybody listening, I said to Cheryl just before we started recording that I'm becoming a little bit more brave in using that phrase, that this diagnosis of arthritis was actually a little blessing in disguise for me. And it means so many things. But I think now that I realize it's been 10 years, now that I look back these 10 years and I'm able to see the struggles that I went through, the pain, like the actual physical pain, the emotional discomforts that I was dealing with, it is actually thanks to them that I was able to become the person I am today. And the person that I am today is resilient, is persistent even more. I don't let people walk all over me. I am so much better at listening to my body's signals and understanding what they even mean. And so many people don't. So many people, and I find it especially outside of the chronic illness communities, so many people are so out of tune from their bodies. And I feel like we were not really given a choice. So we had to learn this very fast. Yes. And that is such a positive thing, because I'm able to wake up, check in with myself, and I'm through that check-in of what's going on in physically, mentally, emotionally, I'm able to give myself more of what I need. And that's like one aspect of that is a blessing. Without that, it would be so much harder to show up for myself, to take care of myself. People outside of the chronic illness community that I have a lot of professional but also personal contact with, they get sick. Let's say they get a cold, they get a flu, they end up in bed for a week, and they have no idea why that happened. They have no idea what they could have done to prevent it. They have no idea actually that the first day that they feel better is not the day to go full on power, but actually, you know, give your body a couple more days rest. And we, and I, by we, I'm mainly referring to the chronic illness community, we're sort of in a position where we're able to, and we get there. This is not something we get from the first day, right? But this is something that we very much just have to learn. We're a little bit more aware on how to support ourselves, support our bodies, whether it's a flare up or whether it's like a sniffle coming on. Immediately, I feel like we sort of know what to do. We know to rest because we know that the body's going to benefit from that.
Yeah. So, no, keep going. Sorry. I'm disagreeing.
You're just agreeing. Love it. Yeah. And that's like one of the biggest parts for me. But the second one that became very obvious to me quite recently is friendships and relationships. As a person living with an autoimmune, there are, and there were more often in the past, days where I had to cancel plans or I couldn't overschedule my calendar because I either ended up in a flare or I just was exhausted, like physically fatigued, tired, and I needed the time for me. And that very quickly, like, weeded out the friends that were not really friends. And yes, that is so damn hard. It is so sad. I went through so much grief about that, about friendships ending, friendships changing. It is not an easy thing to go through. None of this is really, and none of life is really. Everything it can be, and we go through really challenging moments in our life. But if I'm looking at it from this lens of it being a blessing, I very quickly learned what it actually truly means to have true good friends around you. And that's an amazing thing, because now when I meet people and they are supportive, they're accepting, they understand change of plans, that I don't feel like I need to lie to explain and say, oh, actually, I just want to stay in my bed in my snuggie all day. Like, there's actually no other reason why I want to see you, but equally, I just want to stay in my bed today. And that's just what's going to benefit me a little bit more at this moment. So when I meet people that I can say that to, that accept that, and our friendship doesn't change because of that, it makes that friendship so much more valuable. And I'm able to be so much more grateful for it. And that is all thanks to like living with a chronic illness that I have to learn from and listen to every single day.
I feel similar. I feel like in the past, I wanted to always be, I defined my worth as like, I want to be the friend that's always dependable, that helps other people. And I wasn't vulnerable, really. I mean, I was. It's complicated, but at times I would be vulnerable if it was bad enough, like going through a breakup, I would be vulnerable with my emotions or something. But like in general, I feel like I wanted to be the helper. I didn't want to be helped by friends. And I don't know if you've had the same, I'm seeing you're nodding, but it's like learning to letting your friends be there for you when you need help. It's a gift to them as well. Like humans, you know, if you love someone, you want to help them, right? But why is it so hard? I don't know if it's an American thing. Maybe you're nodding, so it's just a person thing. We're raised to think it's, oh, you got, especially as a young person, like I was 21 when I was diagnosed, you know, you got to be independent. You got to do things on your own. It's hard to ask for help, but it can bring you and your friends closer.
If you have ever felt completely lost or utterly alone while trying to navigate real life with rheumatic disease, listen up. I am here for you. I created an educational program to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks, and it's called Room to Thrive. After earning a master's in occupational therapy and completing hundreds of hours of additional training, I created a step-by-step guide to help you truly thrive with rheumatic disease. This is the only program I know of that's designed to improve quality of life for people living with inflammatory, autoimmune forms of arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, Sjogren's disease, and more. During the self-paced lessons, you'll learn how to manage pain and fatigue, cope with stress, navigate relationships, and continue doing the things that matter to you and bring you joy. The goal is really to help you improve your quality of life and learn how to thrive with your rheumatic disease right now, rather than waiting for a distant day when it might be cured or healed. I really created the down-to-earth, practical, heartfelt resource I wish I had had when I was first diagnosed at age 20. If you want even more in-depth support, you can join the 12-week Room to Thrive virtual support group, where you'll be surrounded by people who actually get what you're going through, people who will provide the encouragement, validation, and support that you deserve. Each group is expertly moderated, so you don't have to worry about the kind of misinformation that spreads like wildfire in the free-for-all social media groups. If you're on the fence, don't just take my word for it. Here's what Katie had to say in March 2023. I was lost and overwhelmed with my RA diagnosis. It felt overwhelming to know what to read, what to do, how to spend my energy trying to research on the internet. Room to Thrive did that for me. It's been like getting a crash course in my diagnosis along with a community who gets it. To see all the details, including the dates for the next support groups, go to the link in the show notes or bit.ly/thriveroom with a capital T and capital R. You can also just email me anytime at info@myarthritislife.net. And don't delay if you're interested, because each group is capped at 16 people or less in order to make a small, intimate group atmosphere. Thanks so much for your time, and I can't wait to get started with the next groups. And I can't wait for those of you who are interested in the self-paced option to go ahead and join that at any time. Bye-bye for now.
Oh, totally. I am a recovering people pleaser every single day of my life. And again, this, let's say, recovery of being a people pleaser, of really just wanting to help someone else. And I come from a childhood where emotions were not really a thing. We weren't really allowed to feel bad. It was just, everything's okay, and just smile and everything's fine. So that was also the conditioning that I was very much in. And yeah, so I was wanting always to be there for other people. Nobody would really truly know how I was feeling, because that's not important. I'm good. I'm fine. But then chronic illness came along, and like, it's very difficult to be that way. You try and you end up flaring, and you end up even more tired and exhausted, not even just physically, but mentally. It puts such a bigger strain, I feel, at least it did for me. So again, when that started happening, because not everything changed the moment I got the diagnosis. Like, I mean, I've been living with this for 10 years. So it is a slow, gradual, but I really want to say a beautiful journey of growth, of getting to know ourselves. And yeah, eventually now I'm at a point where I'm able to be honest about how I feel to the people that I trust, to the people that I don't trust and I don't want to build that relationship with, I also just don't anymore. Whereas before, I would sort of force myself, because Paulina needs to be there for everybody and everybody needs her support and help. When chronic illness helped me say no.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really a remedy for being a people pleaser, but I still struggle. I mean, I'm like, I actually made it one of my New Year's resolutions a few years, I think it was the year before COVID, to like stop saying sorry at my medical appointments. Because I, at that point in the mid 2000s, I went through a whole bunch of stuff. Like, I had a car accident and concussion, whiplash injury to my neck and my jaw. And then I got this palynadal cyst on my tailbone that had nothing to do with any of that. it just was random. That usually happens to like older, hairy men. They're like, we don't know why this happened to you. And then, I'm laughing now, but it was horrible. And then I had delayed wound healing from that. And then this is all within 12 months. And then I got a GI virus that was Charlie and I both got when we were throwing up, having diarrhea. He was hospitalized at the Children's Hospital for dehydration. He was just under 3 years old and I was super dehydrated. And then my stomach had a gastroparesis flare. This is all on top of having rheumatoid arthritis. But point being, so I sent out like 32 holiday cards, because again, I'm stubborn. I'm not going to not send holiday cards, even though I'm literally can't function and do anything right now. And it was to different medical specialists, 32 different cards to different medical specialists to thank them for helping me in that year, 2017. But I remember I was still going to appointments and all stuff to recover from all that. And this is why I don't have another child. I have one child. Who knows if I could have, assuming my fertility would have still been there, we would have had another. That was our plan. Our plan was to have another baby, but this all stuff just kept happening to my body. And then it was like, well, I'm now, 39, 40. I don't feel like that's the right decision anymore. We don't feel it's the right decision anymore. But long story short, I'm all leading to this point of saying sorry. So you're nodding to be like, oh my God, you went through so much. And then I'd be at the appointment. And if my issue wasn't easily resolved, or if they'd be like, have you tried this? And I'd be like, sorry, yeah, I have, but I'd be like, sorry, I'm sorry to be complicated. I'm sorry I'm still in pain. I was like, why do I keep saying sorry? And it's not my fault. They're here to help me, and I'm wasting their time and my time saying sorry. And I need to also give myself permission to not be sorry to someone else for my pain. You know what I mean? So anyway, it's complicated.
Totally. But there is just, even in the way that you're saying this, there is so much power that get to feel the moment you pause and you just don't say that word.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is going to give, hopefully, you so much more inner strength of actually, I'm standing in my truth right now. And my truth is, I'm not sorry about that. This is just not the right phrase right now.
Right.
I just feel also, and I don't know, maybe this is a British thing or an American thing, because I had a similar conversation about this when it comes to I love you, the phrase I love you or I love. I feel like the British people really diluted that word. It's like they love everything. They love tea and they love the weather and they love this and they love
I think that. I do that. I am guilty of that for sure.
I feel like maybe if I just link that back to your sorry, the moment that you or we stops apologizing for things that we're not really truly apologizing for, then that word will become a little bit more meaningful again, rather than diluting that word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry, I have one more question. You're like, okay, I have another question. Just say what you have. Because it's if there's one thing of recognizing the humanity of a provider, of a medical provider, and understanding that and that's why I get tripped up, because I understand, for as being an occupational therapist, I understand the pressures that some of the medical providers are under. And so I'm like, oh, I wish I could just be, I wish I could just be an easy patient. And the other day in one of our Room to Thrive support groups, people were like, can I just have a day where my condition is just straightforward? Can I, my body just follow the textbook for one day and not have every day be an exception, that's not the cards we get dealt sometimes. And accepting that goes a longer way than trying to deny it, I think, or submerge it. But the other thing I was going to ask, back to your initial point about being better at listening to your body's signals and having a more, I would, maybe it sounds like more mindful, deep relationship to your body. I'm curious if you ever experienced something that I experienced for a few years, which was actually becoming detached from my body. So I was not actually connected to it as a coping mechanism for being in pain. What's the word for that? I forget what the word is. Where you're depersonalized,
Like detachment or numbing or
numbing,
zoning out of the body. Yeah, totally.
That's hard.
Have I experienced that myself? I feel like I haven't. Maybe I did in the beginning of my journey. Maybe this is why it's hard for me to remember, because again, if I zoned out, I would have zoned out and I wouldn't have remembered it. Because I know that there are a lot of parts, let's say, of my childhood. I had a very complicated childhood, kind of. People looking from the outside would say that it wasn't, but it wasn't a healthy dynamic in my family. So I was 21 when I moved to Germany. And when I look at my life before the age of 21, everything is very blurry. I don't remember a lot. So I also know that this is a coping mechanism. It is our nervous system saying this is too much pain or too scary. There's too much of whatever. And it just decides to forget about it or zone out of it or not even be aware of it. Because I know that it doesn't sound like it's actually a helpful thing, but our nervous system and our body just wants to protect us. And that is the option that it takes as the supporting mechanism for us in that moment. So rather than sort of now feeling bad about that and saying, oh, like, what did you do, nervous system? Don't remember things. Actually, it's a good thing because it was too much for our system to handle. So I know this now, obviously, professionally, this is also something that I've learned. And I'm able now to, let's say, speak about this also more from a professional knowledge as well as this personal experience. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are days or moments or even stages of our journey with a chronic illness where that happens, where we kind of zone out and dissociate. I think
that's the word. Dissociate. I was looking for detaching. Yeah. Dissociating. It's really, really common. And like you said, it's an adaptive evolutionary thing for our brain to say, okay, we are in survival mode. Our brain can't pay attention to all this pain right now, but then long term, like I remember one time my therapist, I'm like, oh my gosh, my therapist has been very patient, you know, was like trying to get me to get in touch with my body, and especially actually for anxiety, not just for coping with chronic pain. And she was like, where do you feel your anxiety? And I was like, it's in my brain. I literally said this sounds like a joke, but I was like, it's in my brain. That's where my thoughts and feelings are. And she goes, no, but like in your body. And I was like, well, my brain's in my body. So it's like in the head.
Oh my God. My brain is in my body.
Sweet thing. Okay. Do you feel any sensation in your body? I'm like, what? That thing that I dissociated from? No, nothing's going on there. You know, took me a long time to realize, oh yeah, like I can feel a little bit of chest tightening and my shoulders, you know, getting a little bit tighter, my muscles tightening around my shoulders and my neck. And I feel like my breath increasing a little bit. I feel a little sweaty, but I honestly was not in touch with my physical body. And I think actually my therapist also said that this is somewhat common with former athletes or current athletes, that you have to learn how to push through pain. And so I'm like, yeah, thinking about different times when I've been so tired and I'm like, we got 15 minutes left on the soccer game. You have to just not think about how, you know, your lungs hurt or your muscles hurt. But I just want to address that because for some people might think, oh gosh, like Paulina is saying has a better relationship with her body, but I feel like, and it's not about comparisonitis, right? We're all different, but it's normal to go through periods where like now I am more in touch with my body, but that was a period where I was dissociated. That's the long, short story long.
Totally, totally. And I think that what helped me, or instill what really helps me stay more in tune with my body and not, I'm not sure if jump is the right word here, but not to get into that dissociative mode is, again, through the support of a therapist, through meditations, like guided meditations, mindfulness. Spirituality and nervous system care is something that I live and breathe every single day right now. And that is something that really highly supports me. I think that coming to myself And sort of even just mentally, for me, affirmations work very well, just like reaffirming things in my mind to tell myself that feeling into my body and feeling this pain or this shortness of breath or like whatever, anything that you've just mentioned now as well, any tingling or sweating, really any sensation, that it's safe, that it's okay, that it's like coming from a loving place, that I just want to lovingly be curious about this. And maybe that then supports my body to be like, okay, let's stay in this and like, let's explore this a little bit more, rather than jumping into that dissociative fear mode, which again, it takes time for us to come out of. And this is done with the support of a therapist. And for me, I've worked with therapists about not just chronic pain and arthritis, but also, let's say, childhood related situations and things and life in general. But now at this point, 10 years into this journey, I'm going to keep repeating 10 years because that's incredible. Mm-hmm. 10 years into this journey, this is still something that supports me on a daily basis. Before I check in with my mind, my body, my spirit, I always come into that place of loving curiosity first to make sure that I'm not analyzing for good and bad, but rather I'm just staying open and curious and kind of accepting for whatever comes, because I know that that knowledge of whatever is present will help me decide, okay, do I have a longer walk today? Should I go into nature? Should I meditate a little bit longer? Should I maybe journal about this a bit more? So whatever sort of check-in it is, it's coming from that loving, curious place, not a good or bad judgmental place, supports me because I know that it's going to give me a bit more knowledge on how I can show up for myself a bit better, how I can take care of myself a little bit better.
I love that phrase, a loving, curious, coming from a loving, curious place. And I think there's this misnomer about mindfulness-based practices, which are misunderstanding, which I used to have. I used to say, well, I can't meditate because I'm too, my brain is too hyperactive. I can't relax. It's not going to work, you know, which is weird because I'm usually really positive, but I was a very like pessimistic outlook, but it was maybe from a place of understanding my native brain's like proclivities, right? I do tend to be a little bit tangential, have lots of thoughts and have a hard time funneling them down into like, let's say sentences. No, just kidding. When it was explained to me, the true root of it, like you just said so beautifully, is non-judgmental awareness and that metacognition of saying, like, instead of being the self, I'm going to take a moment and be like the observing self, like a little Cheryl sitting on a little cloud above me looking down and saying, like, oh, she's having thoughts. Like, let's look at those thoughts with this curious, like, she's having this thought. Let's just notice them. Like, these are little, the thoughts are little leaves on a stream, or they're clouds in the sky. And it's such a beautiful thing because you can have lots and lots of thoughts. Like I do, I have a lot. I think my brain's very active, but that practice of, instead of being in ACT and acceptance and commitment therapy, they call it fused. Like when you're fused to your thoughts versus diffusion, when you just recognize that these are all thoughts, again, like the leaves on the stream or like the clouds floating in the sky, it's a less stressful experience, I think. It reminds you that these are all, the thoughts are just thoughts. Thoughts are thoughts, not facts, you know? And I think that's blending the self-compassion in is the way you said loving, you know, loving, not just curious, like I'm a detective or I'm a scientist, I'm curious about these thoughts. Like I'm lovingly embracing and allowing these thoughts. That's just beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This self-compassion, loving curiosity, as it might have started for me in the journey of exploring my physical sensations and pains and discomforts, it then flew into like discovering what's in my mind and the thoughts that I'm having, the way that I talk to myself, the way that I talk to others. Mm. And then it actually just like spread to everything in my life. And it's so possible, like every interaction that I have, be lovingly curious about it. Everything that I learn, every challenge in my life that I have, there is an opportunity to come to it with a compassionate, loving eye, like a compassionate, loving curiosity and learn from it, but not in a way of judgmental, good or bad. I think that that is a very, it's a place that we can get to very easily. This judgmental and this marking, this saying, this is good, this is bad. But if we can practice coming into self-compassion, it can give us a lot. It can support us a lot.
Yeah. Well, and this may be redundant question, but going into the concluding questions, I have a couple. I call them rapid fire, but they're not always quick. But what words of wisdom would you give to someone newly diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis today?
Don't stay alone. Reach out to every person that you could possibly reach out to. Doctors, like, you're on this podcast, you're listening to this, so you're hearing this answer. Reach out to Cheryl or I. You don't have to be alone in this. And it is a very alone, scary journey in the beginning for a lot of us. And just to talk with somebody can be very supportive. It was for me, and it still is. This is why I'm still here so many times.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And do you have, on a totally different note, do you have a favorite arthritis gadget or tool in your toolbox?
Okay, I had a little think about this question. I used to have so many. Now.
But sometimes you don't need them, and that's okay.
Yeah. Okay. So from the past, my biggest tool one was something that I was, I believe, given, I can't remember by who, maybe a physiotherapist or maybe somebody else, I'm not sure, a thing to open the doors, like a thing that makes the key larger so that I can grasp it more. That was so helpful because I could actually enter the house. So that was one of the biggest tools. And now, because I practice yoga quite regularly, it's wrist supporters, like wrist gloves. Those are with me every day.
Yeah, that's awesome. I just bought some of those as I've been doing some weightlifting lately, strength training, which has been really fun. And yeah, those key grips, they give you a wider lever to twist so you don't have to use as much grip force. It's awesome. Do you have a favorite? This is just because I love pop culture and I love books and movies and shows. Do you have a favorite book or movie or TV show that you've consumed recently?
Oh, recently, it'll definitely be One Day.
Oh, I don't know that one.
The Netflix series. Oh my God. It's most emotional, romantic, sad series. So if you want to have a little cry, that's not about you, but about somebody else's life.
Oh no, I want to. I know it's like, it's like, I'm like, oh, I hate it when the people who should, like, I don't know what the tragedy is, but I can't stop watching those kind of things. Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing. Oh, I'm just looking at the, is it the same guy from Red, White, and Royal Blue?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I'm not
that
sure.
That was really good. That was a really good one. Okay. Do you, oh, this actually relates to what you were saying earlier about you have a lot of good mantras. Do you have a favorite mantra or one that you'd want to share with the audience or affirmation?
Maybe one that I'm reminding myself of more recently is that whatever I'm feeling right now is okay.
Yeah. It's so simple, but so hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, and that's one of the things that I remember reading in one of my trainings on acceptance and commitment therapy, that it can be very, when you start learning that skill of metacognition, thinking about your thoughts and looking at them from that detached standpoint, it can be very destabilizing, because then you're kind of like, it becomes philosophical, like what's real, what's not, what is life, what is, so if you don't pair it with that self-compassion, that loving kindness of like, okay, these are all thoughts and things I'm thinking about and feeling, and they're all okay. That's, it can be very disorienting. So I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. And for me, it was a lot of my journey with rheumatoid arthritis, with childhood related therapy. It was a lot based on suppressing my feelings and not letting myself feel whatever I was feeling, whether it was anger, frustration, sadness, happiness, and joy. Like, I couldn't get into the intensity of any of these emotions because I just, again, was more of a people pleaser rather than staying with what I was feeling. So for me, it is really important to keep reminding myself of this. Like, it's whatever I'm feeling right now, it's okay to feel that. If I feel angry at myself, it's okay to feel this right now, and I'll come out of this, but let me stay in this for a little bit and see what's happening. So yeah.
I can't imagine the hill that you've had to climb for that. Cause I had a very, very supportive, you know, very untraumatic upbringing, you know, with my family. I mean, my therapist referred to them as like a positive outlier, you know, and if those who've listened to episode 100, that's my interview with my parents. They're just amazing people. But there is something that I picked up on, not from them necessarily, but from the culture at large, which is that like that people pleaser in me figured out pretty quickly that like being a good girl and being a good citizen in the classroom meant, you know, sitting with your hands folded quietly in your lap, only ever showing positive emotions, you know, it's not okay. My parents would always comfort me if I was crying or anything like that. But just in general, I felt a pressure to like only feel positive emotions. And I don't know if you can pinpoint where that was from, but I think it's such a beautiful process as an adult now. And parenting my own child, there's a whole other level where you're like, I'm allowing you, I'm letting you know, like a toddler tantrum, like your feelings are okay. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to be mad. It's not okay to hit people, you know, so having there be boundaries around what's acceptable behavior, but all emotions, it's so radical to say that all emotions are acceptable and fine. That is completely a radical thought, you know?
Yeah. It's insane. It's crazy, but it is so, so healing to get there, to be there.
And once you start finding it, it's like, I'm so annoying now. Like I have to bite my tongue so often because when I'm watching my son, like, you know, at like his, a music lesson or a sports thing, I'm like, I want to like rephrase what the coach says or the teacher says. Cause I'm like, oh, you're like so close, but you're telling them like, it's not okay to be frustrated, but it is okay for him. Like if you're trying to play a piano and you play the wrong note, it sounds bad and it's frustrating.
Yes. Like, yes.
So let him feel that, but let him know that it's not okay to quit. It's okay to take a minute to catch your breath and, you know, all that kind of, anyway, sorry. This is, yeah. What is something that's been bringing you joy recently?
Being surrounded by the right people. Mm-hmm. And let me expand on the right term, being surrounded by inspiring people. By people who are lifting me up, who are in some way doing better than I am so that I can learn from them. I can be in their space, be in their energy, be in their world and notice how supportive they can be to me at that same time as well. And that has been my highlight for the past, let's say, 6 months. It's something that I've discovered that I finally have. It's something I've struggled with for my whole life, to have real supportive, uplifting, real friends, like real people, real humans, and not ones that are toxic or there only when they need it to be, and you know, all sorts of people. So actually now I feel like I have a handful of people that are such incredible human beings, and I feel very grateful to have them in my life.
That's amazing. It's amazing that you have that and that you're so appreciative of it, you know, don't take it for granted. That's beautiful. This can be interpreted a lot of different ways. There's just two more questions. One is, would you do anything differently if you were diagnosed today?
No, I feel like everything had to happen the way that it did in order for me to be here. And yes, maybe there are things I would have changed to make things easier for myself. But if I just think about that as a possibility, then I wouldn't have learned everything that I would have, that I learned through the hardships, through the challenges. I went out there, I seeked support. I immediately went onto Instagram as well to like look for people out there, you know, hashtags are amazing for this, to find people with random hashtags that you would have never searched for, like chronic illness or rheumatoid arthritis. Like these are things you search for when you are really in wanting to find people like that. And I did that. So I think, no, I wouldn't necessarily change anything.
That's beautiful. And the last one is, what does it mean to you to live a good life and thrive with rheumatoid arthritis?
To live how I live now.
That's amazing. You're only 28 and you're like, so like, I love it. You're so evolved.
Yeah, it's been a journey for sure. But what does it mean for me? It means to spend most of my days or most of, let's say, life, but in life, I really mean like the hour of each day or the days of each week, spend them doing the things that really uplift me, that bring me joy, that light me up, that make me feel warm inside. Just, there will still be moments, right, and hours in the week where I have to do things that I don't necessarily love and enjoy, like doing my taxes. This is not something I love and enjoy, and I thank you.
Right.
But most of the time in my day, in my week, I get to do what I really love. I get to see the people that I really want to see and support myself in ways that I want to support myself in, and continue checking in with myself in terms of, yeah, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, how am I doing? And this for me means, yeah, living and thriving and feeling joyful with rheumatoid arthritis as a diagnosis, but it's part of my life. It is not right. Me. It is part of everything that's happening in my life too.
I love it. I love it. I mean, that's, yeah, we have to have a little like 10-year-old birthday party for your diagnosis. I was just thinking that my son just had his 10th birthday.
I'm going to look into the day that I was actually diagnosed, because I don't remember the actual date.
Get some like balloons.
I'm going to see if I can find that, because that's incredible. If I could have a 10-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I did that for my 20-year diagnosis anniversary in 2023. I did like these two big balloons that said 20, and it's fun. It's nice. It doesn't have to be the exact date. You know, I knew mine was in August sometime, so I just did it like a random day in August. But anyway, yeah. Thank you so much. This has been really, really, inspiring for me. And I want to make sure people know where they can find you online if they want to connect further.
I would love to chat with anybody. I currently, let's say what I do is I support women, chronic illness and non-chronic illness women, that from living in high stress, trauma-based lives to actually supporting them in living serene, joyful lives. And I do this through nervous system care and spirituality. And the best place to find out a little bit more about what I do and the magic that goes on this side of the world is on Instagram. So you can find me on Instagram at with.paulina. That's probably the best place to find me, talk to me. I am still a human. There is no team behind me. So every message you send to me is going to be received by me and responded by me. It is a small enough account where I'm able to actually chat with everybody. And I love that. And that's how I love to work and continue connecting with people.
I love it. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been really fascinating for me, only knowing you for a few years now, but seeing the transformation from doing, you know, initially yoga and now kind of broadening to the work that you're doing now. It's been really wonderful getting to know you and having your light shine on my world from all the way halfway across the globe over here in Seattle, Washington. But we'll say goodbye for now, but I'm sure I'll see you again soon. We'll do Methotrexate part 5. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you again. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Arthritis Life Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Room to Thrive, an educational program I created from scratch to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks. You can go through the pre-recorded course on your own, or you can take the course along with a support group. Learn more at the link in my show notes, or you can always go to www.myarthritislife.net. And if you like this podcast, I would be so honored if you took the time to rate and review it. I also encourage you to share it with anyone you know who might benefit from it. I also wanted to remind you that you can find full transcripts, videos, and detailed show notes with hyperlinks for each episode on my website, www.myarthritislife.net. If you have any ideas for future episodes, or if you want to share your story or wisdom on the podcast, just shoot me an email at info@myarthritislife.net. I can't wait to hear from you.